So the plan is that I'm gonna just talk for a few minutes, and then that'll give us some time to have a discussion if we want, and then that should kind of wind into our traditional all-day sit to chit-chat as a way of closing the day, just talking about the day, anything we want to. And we certainly won't run past 6 o'clock, but if we run out of things we want to say, we could end a little bit early, and Jen's going to close the hall, and then Cheryl will do the vows. So I wanted to start by talking about something that doesn't seem to have anything to do with practice, and then try to bring it back to practice pretty quickly. And it's something I've been thinking about, and something related to it came up in some stuff that's been going on recently that we've talked about, or people have talked to me about. So I'm going to start with Freud, which is an unlikely Zen teacher. There's a couple little books that Freud wrote in the 20s. One was called Beyond the Pleasure Principle, and the other was called Symptoms, Inhibitions, and Anxiety. And he wrote it, pretty soon after the end of World War I. And one of the things he talks about toward the beginning is war neurosis, in which we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And he noted that working with some of those people and hearing reports about them, that something was going on in their dreams that struck him initially as odd, and that is that they tended to have recurrent, if they'd had some traumatic injury in the war, they tended to have recurrent dreams in which that injury was just about to happen again. And he had a theory of dreams that they had something to do with wish fulfillments, though it's fairly complicated in terms of how that might happen, but or how it might be negotiated. But so he started wondering, in what sense was this something productive to be doing rather than something just horrific that was being visited on these people? And so he decided that what was going on is that they were trying to retrospectively develop the anxiety that they hadn't had time to develop before they were injured, okay? And out of that, he developed this theory of what he called signal anxiety, which he talked about as a kind of inoculation. And I guess the idea was that if something incredibly traumatic happened to you that you did not have any time at all to prepare for, it was psychically really cataclysmic. But that if you had time to develop what he called a signal anxiety, which he analogized to a kind of inoculation, that would be sort of a mild form of the virus and prevent you from the more serious form, that the trauma was less. And so that function was so important that if you hadn't had time to do it, you'd try to sort of magically make up for it retrospectively by dreaming a situation where you had time to develop the anxiety. So from there, I wanted to explore just a little bit, given the fact that it's an adaptive mechanism, is it always adaptive? And I guess an analogy would be, if you heard some of this, the talks that Joan was giving about the self or the constructed self, which has a certain function in protecting the organism, but can sort of take over and go hog wild and think it's the only game in town. And so I guess I'm interested in the notion that for some of us, and I must be at least partly talking about myself or my past self or something like that, you can get into a habit where if a little bit of signal anxiety is good, signal anxiety is your best friend, and so you need to, in all situations of possible danger, possible discomfort, you need to go over in advance the possible bad outcomes to kind of protect yourself against them. Doctor visits might be an example of that. You're going to see some specialist about something, so I got to get prepared in case this worst thing happens. And there would pretty clearly be a point at which that's not a very productive way to get around in the world. I think a sort of related, not identical thing would be the notion that in some way you have to over-prepare, even if you're not necessarily anticipating trauma, but you have to over-prepare all possible situations. And that fits in some sense with the model where it's a kind of magic thinking, but maybe we think sometimes if we can completely construct the story or the narrative and cognize the thing, then we've got it under control. You know, so the it fits in with the sort of habit of mind where if we can, you know, figure it all out in advance, then we're safe. You know, that seems fairly obsessive to me, and I wanted just to point out that there are highly obsessive elements of Zen practice. You know, we know exactly what we're going to do. We do the same thing each time. Things are very formalized. We're more informal than most Zen traditions, but there really is that sense of entering a totally predictable world. So it's possible that people who are drawn to Zen practice sometimes might overlap with people who are over-cognizers, you know. It's interesting in practice, though, that we do those regular things not in order to make everything completely predictable, but in order to free us up for the completely unexpected and the unpredictable. And anybody who sat this retreat today, or anybody who's been on a multi-day retreat, and certainly anybody who's worked with Joan, has a very lively and sometimes painful sense that the purpose of what's expected in practice is to lead us really to be able to, you know, go down the well when we have to accept the unexpected. So I wanted to turn just to a really quick story about Lin Ji that I've read. And you know, he's the great Chinese teacher who in Japanese is called Rinzai, and the founder, therefore, of Rinzai Zen. So he was the star student of Wang Bo. And the story is that there was some monastery off someplace else that had sort of fallen into disrepair. You know, everybody was sort of slothful. They weren't practicing very hard. There wasn't much energy there. And they had some relation to Wang Bo's group. And so Wang Bo sent Lin Ji to, you know, to go see what was going on and take care of business. And the story is that as he's sending him off, he says, "What are you going to do when you get there?" And Lin Ji says, "When I get there, I'll know what to do." And then it turns into one of these fairy tale Zen stories. So I'll just tell a quick version of it, though what I just said is the point of the story in the present circumstance. But apparently he gets there, and he was one of the shouters, and he was one of the famous shouting Zen teachers. So he gets there, and he walks into the hall, and the teacher doesn't at first notice that he's there. And just as the teacher kind of notices that he's there and looks up, Lin Ji gives one of those incredible shouts, you know, that kind of startles everybody. And then just as the teacher starts to open his mouth, he turns and pivots and walks out of the hall, Lin Ji does. And then somebody asks, "Well, what did he mean by that?" And the teacher says, "Oh, if you want to know, you have to ask him." And about 80% of the people in the hall go, "Follow Lin Ji out, you know. But anyway, you know, when I get there, I'll know what to do." And it seems to me that clearly that wouldn't always be the best attitude. I run a PhD program, and if my graduate students taking their 3-hour oral exams just said, "Oh, I figured when I get there, I'd know what to do, so I didn't read any of the books," you know, that wouldn't be a good approach to things. But I think one of the things that can happen with Zen practice is that it can give you the confidence to say in the appropriate circumstances, "When I get there, I'll know what to do," and to increasingly maybe have a better sense of what those moments are, what things are figure outable in advance, and which ones are not, and the kind of tranquility is probably not quite the right word, but the tranquility to leave it alone when you ought to leave it alone. And so not knowing is most intimate would be in the neighborhood here, or Keats talking about negative capability also. About a month or two ago, in the Tuesday night group, Mary brought in a talk of Norman's that I'll say just a tiny bit about. That seemed to me, you know, to be about, part of it was really about very much the same thing. And it was a talk on the 5 hindrances, which I don't really know anything about, although I should. And those are apparently sort of 5 habits that can get in the way of good Zen practice. And the 5th one is called doubt. And that's kind of funny because we know in our tradition that great doubt is really important. But I think what's being referred to here is kind of niggling doubt or lack of trust. And that's apparently one of the hindrances to good Zen practice. And when Norman was talking about it, he talked about a thing that was very similar to what I've just been talking about. That is the sort of obsessive need to try by all possible means to get everything figured out in advance to assure a good outcome. He said that his wife, Kathy, for a long time was a negotiator, a union negotiator for schools who would negotiate contracts, and that when she was learning to be a negotiator, she learned about BATNA, and that she was told that all negotiators had to have a BATNA. And apparently BATNA is best alternative to negotiated agreement. And so the idea was that if you were going to go into negotiations with the school board, you had to have one plan for what you would do if the negotiations fell through. And then once you had that plan, you could forget about it and you could go into the situation and negotiate. And so Norman's point, I guess, was that, you know, you make the best BATNA you can, and then you leave it the hell alone and, you know, go into the experience and see what happens. He talked a little bit also, but he said that if you're really sick and you might be dying, he said that that was the mother of all BATNAs. You know, so in some circumstance, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement might be, oh, then I die, you know, and that's a useful BATNA to have in your back pocket. At any rate, it reminded me of two things that John talked about a few years ago and had us working on. And so one was, do you trust your death? And another one was, do you trust your life? And it seems to me that on some crucial level, an attitude of trust about your life allows you to act a little more in the Linji mode and a little less in the trying to cognize everything in advance mode. One student at the retreat in Oracle that we just had was working on that and had a great response, which was to the answer of, do you trust your life? First answer was no, and then the reformulation of that was hell no. And I think it's useful, just the way if we're working on the Linji Cohen, there's nothing I dislike, it's really useful to plug into the level on which you dislike a lot of stuff, and that lets you see the extent maybe or the way in which you do, there is nothing you dislike. That in a similar way, to be quite frank about hell no, I don't trust my life, is part of the process of working on the Cohen, you know, do you trust your life? I wanted to just say one other thing, kind of an afterthought in a way, but in a way what I've been talking about also is the notion that, or the belief that if everything is well prepared, including me, a good outcome is assured. If things are not well prepared, then a good outcome cannot possibly take place. And this last story is to be taken with one caveat, which I'll mention in a second, but the one time I met Ross Bolliter, who's an Australian teacher, who's a student of John's as well as Aiken's, he was staying over at my friend Bill Scott's house, and I went over there and had dinner, and Ross started talking about his career as a jazz musician and somebody who played in cocktail lounges also. And he said that for a long time he was really convinced that if he was really overtired, he would go in there and it would just be for shit, you know, so he was really worried about it. And that if he was really well rested, he would play great. And he started being a Zen teacher also, he started tracking it. And he said there was no discernible relation at all to how he was feeling when he went in and how he played, you know. So I had always been somebody who was pretty obsessively nervous about enough sleep. And I started tracking that to, let's say, going in to teach classes at the university. I was tired if I was tired, but it seemed to have no discernible relation at all to how the class went. So that notion that, you know, if we can get everything under control, it's going to work out well, pragmatically probably is not true in a lot of instances. The caveat would be, you all know this better than I do probably, but it's still not good for your health to only always get 4 hours sleep. You know? So you can try it sometimes, but you don't want to live your whole life that way. And so that's all I wanted to say. So we can talk about that a little bit or slide over to our chat about the day.
Well, when you talked about the doubt being one of the five, whatever they are, hindrances or whatever, I heard another talk that included that recently by Tara Brach, and I can't actually remember what she said, but when you said that, the thing that came to me was self-doubt is the thing that's so pernicious.
Yeah. Right. I think that's right. Yeah, that's right. The other thing in the woman formulation, remember, is that to work on the Cohen no and to practice, you need a great ball of doubt,
right?
Which means really, on some fundamental level, you know, don't know. You know, there's some mystery, and then at the same time, you need a great root of faith, which would be both, I think, in the possibility of awakening and the possibility that you can realize it. So yeah, I think that the kind of niggling doubt is the opposite
more
of that.
More the self kind of doubt, yeah, to me. And then there's, of course, the great perseverance. But yeah, they seem like very different doubts, those.
Yeah,
two.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So I see doubt and faith on two ends of a line that's one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because in some way, right, if you didn't have a great root of faith, you couldn't tolerate the great doubt, right? To be able to sit there for years maybe saying, I don't know. You'd have to in some way, you know, have a belief that something can come out of that, I think. Or a faith that something can.
That's what you mean by the great doubt, then, is the, over the course of practice that arises.
Yeah, people say that the more you work on a first koan like no, unless you're one of the very few people who just sits down and that's it, you know, that it really throws, you have a very sometimes excruciated sense that on some fundamental level there's something that you want to be revealed or know that you don't know and isn't revealed. And the way John talks about it, then usually sort of all your smaller doubts get piled onto the bigger doubt. You know, why am I X? Why can't I Y? Those things become versions of the great doubt also. So in some way, I guess that's a little bit close to, you know, the self-doubt, but maybe it transmutes it.
It's, you know, way close to it. It's, you just spun my head around in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, that would be the thing maybe about the koan, you know, provoking the delusion to which,
yes,
it's the antidote,
yes,
right? That the great doubt stirs up. And that's part of the discomfort of working on stuff like that, right? That it does stir up all kinds of self-doubt too, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also explained to my mind the recurring childhood dream I had, why I had it.
Oh, wow.
That idea of trauma, that's very interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Needing to be replayed.
Yeah. The other thing he says is, I was going to talk about it, it's a little less directly pertinent, but I think it's cool, is that he says a lot of childhood play has the same function, mm-hmm, and that what'll tend to happen is that in play, the situation will be repeated, but also reversed, so that the child will go from the passive role to the active role. So if you had a traumatic trip to the dentist, you endlessly play dentist with your friends, mm-hmm, but guess who gets to be the dentist, you know? So that yeah.
Yeah, passive to active and powerless to power.
Yeah, yeah. So what about the day for people? Should I turn the recorder off for this?
Okay.